everyone. Welcome back to the Public Interest Environmental Law Podcast, brought to you by Peel UK. We are your hosts, Steffi,
Roserin,
and Jocelyn.
And today we have with us Gert van der Bijl. I hope you enjoy today's episode.
Welcome to the podcast, Gert. How are you doing today?
Yeah, so my name is Gert van der Bijl. A very Dutch name, so indeed difficult to pronounce for foreigners. Yeah, I'm absolutely delighted to be here, and maybe let me first introduce myself briefly. I work for Solidaridad. Solidaridad is an international development organization. We work with around 1,200 people around the globe, so people on the ground, mostly in the southern part of the globe, so in 40 countries in Asia, Africa, and Latin America. I'm based at our European office. I've been working for Solidaridad for 15 years now. Before that, I worked 20 years in the Dutch agriculture. And since 3 years, I'm responsible at Solidaridad for advocacy around the European deforestation regulation, which will be the main topic of this podcast. So in the first 2 years, my focus has been mostly on trying to influence policymakers in Brussels to make the regulation more smallholder friendly. And now I'm working with quite a lot of actors in coffee, cocoa, rubber and palm oil, including a lot of colleagues around the globe, on setting up structures to make the EU deforestation regulation work out in a positive way. So that's in general me. I graduated long ago as a development economist at the Agricultural University here in Wageningen. So my background is very much in agriculture and development.
Great. Thank you for your introduction. Now that you've introduced yourself, would you mind introducing Solidaridad very briefly and its main objectives, for example?
Yeah. Well, very short. Well, first of all, we have the Spanish name because around more than 50 years ago, we were founded as a Catholic organization here in the Netherlands, working with Catholic local groups in Latin America and to support them in developing starting from the Catholic Church. So a lot of those people that we were working with in countries like Mexico and Guatemala, Colombia at that time, were coffee farmers. And at a certain moment, one of the priests came to our director and asked, "Why don't you do something to improve the life of our coffee farmers? It's nice that you from the church support us, our churches here, but can't you do something to ensure that coffee farmers get a better price?" And in the end, that ended up in Solidaridad being one of the founders of Fair Trade Coffee, or the Dutch name was Max Havelaar at that time, around 35 years ago. Also working more and more with coffee farmers on improvement of their production and getting a higher income and basically, first of all, surviving. And over the years, we have developed our organization. Now it's an international network with around 1,200 people in 40 countries. We no longer work in coffee alone, but in 13 different supply chains, so from coffee to cocoa, but also palm oil, and including textiles and gold. Mostly working with producers, first of all, to improve their life, to ensure they get a better income. And often doing that with other organizations throughout the supply chain, sometimes still with a fair trade perspective, but also realizing that there are more roads ending up in Rome with different routes, but usually, and I think I can say always, working very much from a market perspective. So, we have an office, we have two offices here in Europe with around 60 people working there, one office in Germany, one in the Netherlands. And we're now an international organization, so no longer Dutch but with people working across the globe, and our offices in Africa have the same status as our European office. So that's sort of what it does.
Brilliant. Thank you so much for your introduction to Solidaridad. And it's really interesting to hear about not only the work that you do now, but also the origin of Solidaridad. Just in terms of, you mentioned that like a lot of the work that we personally are doing at the moment is sort of trying to improve the lives of smallholders, and doing that partly through EU regulation at a new level. And I was wondering, who are the key actors you're working with in order to do this?
Well, maybe first a bit of background, and also there, over the years we have worked a lot with companies, but also with consumers and all kind of actors throughout the supply chains on voluntary measures, and working also with Rainforest Alliance certification, other certification schemes, and with companies that are voluntary taking steps. And after decades of working on that, we see progress, and also fair trade has had impact, but limited. The market share of fair trade overall is around 2%. In coffee and cocoa, there are other initiatives with a, let's say, a broader reach. But overall, what we see is that all these voluntary measures do not do enough to really move the needle and to move sectors towards real sustainability. And that's why we as Solidaridad have been also promoting policy measures and obligatory measures for quite some time. And as such, we think this European deforestation regulation is a good initiative, because it does force companies that so far have stayed behind and thought, well, sustainability is something for others, to act and step up as well. So overall, we support the idea, and we have been promoting the idea of mandatory measures for quite some time. This European deforestation regulation has been in discussion since, I think 2017. So it has had quite a long history. I've been involved for more than 3 years now. Before that, I coordinated our work on soy globally, and after that, our work on livestock and leather. In the first 2 years, our focus has been mostly on policymakers in Brussels. So I had a lot of contact with people in the European Parliament, but also people from ministries in different member states, people from the European Commission that were involved in policymaking. And most of our activities, I must say, were focused at the European Parliament, together with Fair Trade Advocacy and Rainforest Alliance and Fern and Tropenbos, which are environmental NGOs. Quite intensive contact with a lot of people in the European Parliament, and also had a long paper with amendments that we wanted them to approve. And in fact, quite a number of them have been improved, asking for support measures for smallholders to be able to comply, asking for good cooperation with producing countries, so that it's not only Europe telling the story, but that it's really done in partnership and cooperation with producing countries. Quite a lot of these amendments had a majority in the European Parliament, but European policy making then says that there's a next step, which is the trilogue, where the European Commission, the European Parliament, and the member states sit together and try to find a compromise, which will then end up in the final legislation. Not all of the amendments that we had proposed and that the European Parliament had agreed on did make it until the end. But what we are quite proud of, and I'm still am, is that at least the notion that it is important to ensure that this is all being done in a smallholder inclusive way, I think it's now clear to a lot of people involved, both public and private. And that doesn't mean that everything will end up positively, but what I think at least we have reached is that there is a lot of talk and also a lot of attention on how can we make sure that this will in the end have a positive impact for smallholder families in the global south. And so now, since let's say more or less a year, the legislation is final. And now in this, we are more or less, let's say in the second phase of implementation, where governments, but also companies are now building systems to make this work. And I have a lot of contact with people in the private sector, with both umbrella organizations and individual companies in the different sectors, but also with people in the governments, in the different member states on how we can make sure that this will actually work out positively.
Thank you for that. Before we go deeper into the UDR, I actually have an improvised question here regarding fair trade. Would you mind telling us a little bit about, more about it and what it is, especially for our listeners? Maybe is it, if you're talking about the label, how much can we trust it? How reliable is it? And how strong of a protection does it offer?
Yeah, well, the basic idea behind fair trade is, well, first of all, that producers get a guaranteed and better price if they produce in a sustainable way, and that this will be translated into a price where in the end the consumers will be responsible for paying that higher price. And when we started fair trade in the Netherlands 30, 40 years ago, we were very convinced, and it was also based on market studies, that in 5 or 10 years' time, this would have a market share of 30-40% in coffee, because a lot of consumers said that they are, in the end, willing to pay more for sustainable products. After 10 years, the market share was around 2%. And then we evaluated it and concluded that in the end, it's not that consumers or an important part of consumers don't find sustainability important or are not willing to pay more for it, but that is one of the many things that consumers find important. They also want quality, they want a certain brand, and that makes it a lot more complicated to reach an important part of the market. So, and if you look at where fair trade is now, it is, let's say, a separate niche market. I think you can be sure that farmers do get a better price. Part of that price is paid to cooperatives, and farmers can decide together in cooperatives how they use that funding. There are sometimes also stories and research saying that there are still problems in around fair trade certified cooperatives or farmer groups. Yes, it will not solve everything, and for instance, one issue is also payment for laborers. There are requirements under fair trade, and farmers do get a better price, so at least they are in a position to also pay a better price to their workers. But it doesn't mean that there will be there are guarantees that there are no problems at all, and yes, they are controlled and there are audits, but you can't control everything with audits, and also you shouldn't want that, because if you do that, the cost of audits will be so high that a large part of the premium will be used for audits, and that's not what you want. So there will be issues, but I think in the end, the most important impact that fair trade has had is that it has shown that a lot is possible, and that companies and markets can help to promote sustainability. Because when we started Fair Trade 30, 40 years ago, the first thing that our director did was talking with coffee companies and ask them, do you find sustainability important and do you see a role for yourself in ensuring that farmers have a better life? The answer was no. That's not our role. We are in the market. And at least that is something that has dramatically changed. And I'm not saying that coffee companies are now philanthropic organizations, but at least they realize that they do have a responsibility for what is happening in the supply chain. And I think their fair trade has played a very, very important role.
And just to follow up very quickly before we move on to the UNDR, another question is on fair trade again. Does it offer any environmental guarantees? And how, for example, does it treat the question of deforestation?
Yeah, that's a good question. There are environmental guarantees, so there are rules, but the emphasis is more on the social part. There is no absolute guarantee or fixed control that there is no deforestation at all. But I'm quite certain that coffee farmers or cocoa farmers that are fair trade certified will have less deforestation on average than others.
And just following up along those lines, with the emergence of the EU deforestation regulation and the Corporate Sustainability Due Diligence Directive that the EU has also put into motion, do you think either of these regulations, or is there another regulation that will force companies, for instance, coffee companies or cocoa companies, to pay farmers a living income or at least a better income in their supply chain?
Yeah, I think in the end, that is for us the key question. One of the amendments that had been approved by the European Parliament on the EU deforestation regulation was exactly on this. It did not reach the finish line. And there is still a consideration in the introductory part of the legislation saying that companies should also pay a good price to ensure that farmers, that also the root causes of deforestation, which is often poverty, are being addressed. But it's not translated into a legal requirement in one of the articles. In the final text of the due diligence legislation, it has not been published yet. But from what we know about it now, is that one requirement in the due diligence legislation, the CSDDD, will at least be that farmers or that companies will also need to see how their purchasing practices contribute to sustainability issues, including low income of farmers. And also in the annex that mentions the sustainability issues that are in scope, also living income is mentioned. And that does not give, I think, in the end, an absolute legal requirement for companies to pay a minimum price so that farmers will, if they have a certain size and a certain productivity, to reach a living income. But at least what it does ask and require companies to look at their own behavior and not just, and this is what we see happening a lot in the voluntary market now, is that companies translate sustainability only in requirements for their suppliers and say, if you want to sell to us, you should do this, you should do this, and you should do that, without actually paying for them and without actually looking at what their own contribution is. And well, we do hope and that this due diligence legislation will at least contribute to also companies being forced to also consider their own role and hopefully will also provide hooks for others to say to companies, hey, there is an issue there and you are paying peanuts, so you are to blame as well. Yeah, and yeah, I think in the end, the challenge of this combination of different legislation is indeed that it will not be translated into additional requirements for farmers and suppliers, but that it will lead to more sustainable behavior and hopefully also a shift in the power balance in supply chains. But that will definitely be a challenge.
Thank you so much for that. I think now we're going to move on to focus a little bit more specifically on the EUDR. Would you mind just for our audience giving us its broad lines and how it will work?
Yeah. Well, overall, the European Deforestation Regulation, I think it's first of all important to explain, the background of where it comes from. The very idea behind it is, first of all, that deforestation is a very important contributor to the climate problem. Globally, around 15% of greenhouse gas emissions are directly related to deforestation. Because if you cut down trees, CO2 will be emitted. And an important part of this deforestation is related to expansion, also for the European market. The European Commission has calculated that 10 to 16% of all deforestation is the direct result of the products that are used in Europe every year. And so that is why, as part of the overall strategy of making Europe climate neutral by 2050, the European Commission has said, if we really want to reach that, we should also address the deforestation that is embedded in our consumption, and most of that is embedded in our imports. So that's why the European policymakers have said what we want is to ensure that what we use or what we import is free of deforestation, and that has been translated in a number of requirements. First of all, you need to know where the product comes from, and that is an absolute starting point. If you as a company don't know where your coffee has grown or where the palm oil tree has been or where the cow has grazed, you cannot ensure that it's not coming from recently deforested areas. So that's the first thing. You need to have a geolocation, a point of where the product comes from. And if you import it in Europe, you need to be able to show where it comes from, which also means that you need to trace the products. And that is quite a demanding requirement, because a lot of companies now have no clue where the product comes from, or sometimes also feel quite confident of not knowing, because then they're also not responsible for how it's being produced. So that's the first thing. You need to know where it comes from. Then second, you need to ensure that it's not coming from land that has been deforested after the 31st of December 2020. And you need to ensure that it's produced according to the local laws on human rights, on tax, so also on things that are social and not necessarily related to deforestation, which overall makes it quite demanding. And this will be the case, and that will be introduced in reality on the 1st of January 2025. And from that date onward, for all the products on the list, that is soy, palm oil, coffee, cocoa, wood, beef, and rubber, plus some derived products like leather, but also chocolates or rubber gloves, all companies in Europe importing it or selling these products in Europe, but also exporting it from the European market, will need to have a system to ensure this. So this is extremely demanding. And it will definitely change the system. It will have a tremendous impact. And what we see now is that all companies in these sectors are very nervous and working very hard to make this happen, and also are quite serious in realizing this and because one thing that the legislation also says is that there is a potential fine that can add up to 4% of the annual turnover. So a lot of companies, and it's also a requirement for retailers, for instance, that sell chocolate. They will need to have a proof that this chocolate is deforestation free. And if there is a case, there is in potential a threat that they will have a fine of 4% of their chocolate turnover. Yeah, and that for a large retailer is quite something. So they all say we are very serious in building up systems because, yeah, we don't know if we really get this fine, but we want to be sure that we won't.
That's brilliant. Thank you. Small and medium enterprises, as well as larger companies, are clearly under a lot of pressure to comply with the regulation by the 1st of January 2025. Have you noticed that producing countries and smallholder farmers and communities in the global south are also nervous about complying with the regulation by this time? And do you think...
Oh, definitely. Yeah. Well, first of all, a lot of producing countries are nervous. And I know of two letters sent by a large group of producing countries sent to the European Commission, asking with I think both of them signed by 70-80 different countries in Africa, Asia, and Latin America, complaining about the regulation and saying that it's a unilateral thing and it should have been done in partnership, and that what they have done so far should be taken more seriously. Both letters were, I think, to a very large extent, the initiative of Brazil. And if there is one country that is very serious in preparing for this legislation, then it is Brazil. So, yes, countries are nervous, but a lot of countries are also doing quite a lot to make sure that they will be able to meet the requirements and that their farmers and cooperatives do have systems to trace the products, which will no doubt be easier for well-organized countries like Brazil than for a country like Uganda or Tanzania in Africa. So yes, producing countries are quite nervous. And also, for instance, Indonesia and Malaysia in the palm oil sector, they have been very explicit and have had a lot of discussions with the European authorities, but also expressed in the media what their concerns are, including concerns for palm oil smallholders. And yes, there are smallholder groups that have expressed their concern and have asked for support to ensure that cooperatives do have a good organization to be able to comply with it. But there have also been smallholder groups that have said, for instance, cooperatives in cocoa and Ivory Coast and some organizations also in palm oil in Indonesia that have said, we also see this as an opportunity to make sure that that there is a partnership with our suppliers, that we get that we can cut out middlemen, and to ensure that we get a direct payment through, so not by cash, but through banks, and that there will be more information sharing on internet. So there is also a group of smallholders that say we see this as an opportunity to improve our income and to have a better and closer relation with our suppliers and also to cut out middlemen. But there is, I think, a very broadly shared conviction that there is a lot to be done to really make this work.
Thank you. I hear that. From what you say, producing countries feel like it might have been a unilateral form of regulation. Do you think smallholder farmers and even some of the producing countries were consulted sufficiently adequately during the negotiations?
I think the answer can only be no. And I mean, there have been consultations, and that is also, let's say, a formal procedure in Europe, that Europe opens up websites where you can raise your concerns or share your opinion. And also there, yeah, indeed, farmers organizations from the global south and producing countries have had the opportunity to react like you and me also had. And I have no doubt that there will have been discussions with producing countries as well. But for instance, last year, I presented on request of our local team in Peru what the European deforestation regulation looks like, and had a discussion with representatives from farmer organizations in cocoa and coffee in Peru, and also government representatives. And yeah, quite a lot of them hardly knew anything about what this would be about. And yeah, I can imagine if you have a farmer cooperative in San Martin in Peru, yeah, that you are not really closely following the European policy developments. And so we see it also as our role and role of others to, yeah, at least inform farmers and farmers organizations of what yeah, is going to happen and what the consequences for them will be. And yeah, certainly for less organized farmers groups, yeah, this will be a challenge. In the end, I think it's important to realize that the requirements that are there are requirements for companies that bring these products on the European market. So for cocoa or coffee or rubber, the ones that first need to meet these requirements are the traders that bring these products on the European market. And companies further down in the supply chain, retailers, etc., yeah, will ask them, where does it come from, and can you ensure us that it's deforestation-free and legally produced? But these traders will then translate this, or are likely to do that, into requirements for their suppliers. And so if they buy a product, yeah, they will want to be sure that they have the geolocations available of where a product has been grown. And for instance, to give you an example that a colleague of mine working in palm oil in Indonesia often uses, in palm oil, for instance, 60% of palm oil production in Indonesia comes from plantations. 40% comes from smallholders. A part of these smallholders are loosely organized, don't have fixed relations with buyers. And if they sell their palm oil, they often put the fresh fruit bunch across along the street. There is something with someone with a bicycle or a motorcycle that picks it up, that sells it to someone else. And then that person sells it to someone with a small van. And then there are 3-4 different intermediates or middlemen before it ends up in the mill. And when it's there, it has been mixed and can only sell it to Europe from next year onwards if you have not mixed it with sources that are unknown or where you don't know where it comes from. So that does require quite something for the organization of such a supply chain. And yeah, it's not really set in stone that the buyers of these products will actually pay for that. And there is a risk that companies, and that is also a risk in coffee and other sectors, will focus their sourcing on the well-organized suppliers, and that can also lead to shifts in sourcing in coffee. For instance, some companies in coffee are already saying, or at least implicating, that yeah, it may result in them buying more in the well-organized coffee countries like Brazil or Vietnam, where 50-60% of the coffee comes from, and where they have easier access to these geolocations and where it's easier to guarantee that it's legally produced, and that they will buy less from Tanzania or Ethiopia, where there are a lot more farmers with smaller plots, where there's a lot more mixing, and where it's more difficult to ensure legal compliance. And yeah, that's exactly what we want to avoid, and where we are also urging governments to ensure that there are good systems, but first of all, also urging companies to work with their suppliers to ensure that they will be able to meet the requirements and not run away.
Sorry, feel free.
And what I wanted to add, and I think there is also one additional concern, if at least that I have, is that the UK is preparing a different set of legislation, which I think is absolutely not helpful for two reasons. One is that it may mean that if a farmer cooperative in Uganda is selling coffee to a European company and coffee to a UK company, they will need to have two different systems, because what the UK legislation is now proposing is to ensure that your deforestation should not be illegal. That is requiring quite something different from what the European legislation asks. So for a coffee company in or a cooperative in Uganda, that adds complication, because they will need to have two different systems. But also, a lot of the products that are imported in UK are first imported in Rotterdam, or are coming through Europe. So that would also mean that companies would have need to have two different systems. And I don't see a lot of logic there.
Do you think there has been any attempt to create synergy between the UK Environment Act and the EU Deforestation Regulation? Has there been any dialogue, sort of EU-UK dialogue, do you think? Or are they really developing in isolation from one another?
Well, from what I see, at least the result or the outcome is that they are separate, and they don't, as a system, don't communicate. And that it would at least help if they would have a common basis. And then let's say a UK module and Europe module. I don't see that happening. I remember I was at a coffee conference last year with one of the board members of the British Coffee Association. And, well, they had quite an interesting story of how they, as a British Coffee Association, are preparing for the EUDR. And then I said, I thought you had stepped out of the European Union. Why are you preparing for the EUDR? And he said, yeah, we are convinced that we will need to do this anyhow. Also, if we import to Europe, if we export to Europe, so we need to build this system anyhow. And then on top of it, we also need to build a system for the UK legislation. I think that is, yeah, a waste of resources, but also not making life easier for coffee, rubber, or cocoa producers.
And for our audience, do you mind just clarifying exactly how the EUDR will function in practice, in terms of if cocoa beans are grown in Ghana and then they're exported to the US and they're processed in the US and manufactured into chocolate there, and then that chocolate is exported from the US to the EU, will it still have to comply with the regulation?
Yeah. Yeah, I think that's a very good question. Well, the annex of the regulation has a list with product codes of all the products that are included. And you mentioned the example of cocoa. On the list, there is cocoa, but there is also chocolate and products containing chocolate. So for each company that brings these products on the market, you will need to have a system to ensure that you know where it comes from, that you can guarantee that's deforestation free, and that you can have at least a minimum guarantee or a negligible risk, as the regulation says, that there is any breach of local laws. How it will end up will depend also partly on the market share that Europe has. In cocoa, Europe has between 50 and 60% of the global market. So in cocoa, Europe is definitely the main player on the world market. So I've asked several companies in the cocoa sector, how are you going to deal with this? Are you going to build two different systems, one for exporting from Ghana or Ivory Coast, which jointly produce more than 60% to Europe, and one for export to China or the US? And then most of them say, no, we are going to build one system. One system, regardless of where it's going to. And that is also because there is this list of different products. If a company like Buddy Callebaut, one of the largest cocoa traders, they sell cocoa beans to China. In China, there is a chance that they will be processed into cocoa butter or chocolate. And then after that will be exported to Europe. So if they are then imported as cocoa butter or chocolate in Europe, they will need to have this proof and this registration anyhow. So what they say is, yeah, that makes it easier for us not to have two different systems, but to ensure that everything that is coming from Ghana will meet the European requirements. I think that is likely for cocoa. For palm oil or soy or beef or rubber, where Europe has maybe 10% of the world market, this will be different. It also depends on what exactly are the products on the list. So indeed for cocoa, all products coming from cocoa, chocolate, etc., cocoa butter, etc., are also on the list. So if you import these products, you will have to meet the same requirements. Soy, to give you another example, most of the soy is used as animal feed or soy oil. Well, soy is on the list. So if you import as a company soy from Brazil, and use that in animal feed, you will need to meet the requirements. But if you import poultry or pork from Brazil, those products are not on the list. They can be fed with soy, but then the requirements are not there. So it also depends on how it will work and what are the exact products on the list. There are discussions that after 2 or 3 years, other products, including maybe eggs and poultry meat, will also be added to the list, but that's for the future.
Thank you for your answer. I think that we're moving on to something very applied here, and I have a very applied question too, both from a consumer perspective, but also from a producer perspective. I imagine this is going to increase the price of production. So who do you think is going to bear the cost of this, the cost of this increase? Do you think it's going to be more on the consumer side? So, for example, a rise in prices, or will it result in, for example, lower wages for the people working along the supply chain?
Yeah, I think that is a very, very important question. One thing is that this is a requirement for everyone. So that at least gives me a bit of confidence that it will be translated into costs that in the end will be taken up by the supply chain. Where I'm afraid of, and that is also where I see the risk of exclusion of smallholders, where I'm afraid of is that it will be translated into lower prices for suppliers. Or that companies will say, well, you can sell it to us, but then it's up to you to ensure that you meet the requirements and we're not going to pay for it. Yeah, that is a risk. But I think the advantage is here, different from, let's say, the voluntary measures that we have seen so far, is that each and every company will need to meet the requirements. But that, again, also gives the risk, because I've also heard some companies say, yeah, if we now buy certified products, yeah, that is a voluntary thing and we need to pay for this. Yeah, this is a legal requirement. And yeah, we don't pay for legal requirements. So yeah, it will in the end depend on market dynamics. And I do hope that it will be translated into and taken up by the market and end up with prices that will be paid by higher prices that will be paid by consumers. And if you look at the most important commodities involved, for instance, for coffee or cocoa, around 7% of the consumer price ends up with the farmer. So it doesn't mean that if at farm level the cost will be higher, that it will have tremendous or dramatic consequences for the consumer price. That's not needed. It can be, I think, even if there are costs at farm level, it can be done in a way that doesn't dramatically increase the consumer price.
And recently, I think in sort of December 2023, the European Union launched the Team Europe initiative, which aims to help producing countries and smallholders to meet the requirements of the EU deforestation regulation. Do you think that this is adequate in order to help them comply with the regulation, or do you think that more help is needed, and whether that's financial or technical or capacity building support?
Yeah, I really, really hope that this Team Europe initiative, as it's now, is a start. Because yeah, if you look at the magnitude, it's I think the latest figure that I've seen that there is now something like 70 million euros available for support. Yeah, that is far from what in the end is needed to really make this work adequately. Certainly, because what is needed, and also that is what the legislation also said, what is needed in support for producers and in partnership with producing countries is not only to ensure compliance, but in the end also to work with producing countries to address the root causes of deforestation. So if you really want to reduce deforestation in cocoa or in coffee, yeah, you need to work on reducing poverty and on making coffee production more climate resilient, because one of the reasons for deforestation in coffee is climate change, which means that coffee produced in lower regions in altitude become less productive, which means that farmers start growing coffee in at higher altitudes, which often means deforestation. So if you want to address that, you should support farmers and work with farmers in becoming more climate resilient. And there are ways to do that with other varieties, with agroforestry, but that does require quite something. So what is there now is 70 million, and I think 3-4 countries being involved, and also people involved in the Team Europe initiative say this is the start, but yes, a lot more is needed.
I'm delighted that you answered this question by talking on about climate change, because that was actually a big part of our questions, and I think you addressed it very well. And I think we're becoming a little bit
That there is a very close relation, of course, between deforestation and climate change. One is that deforestation itself is an important contributor to climate change, but also the other way around is that the very occurrence of climate change also triggers deforestation, because it makes farming systems vulnerable. And does trigger farmers to move to other areas and other productions.
That's very relevant. Steffi, did you have a question you wanted to ask before the final question?
I just on a similar or related but different point, more potentially about biodiversity loss than about climate change, do you think there's a concern that the EU deforestation regulation, because it's targeting specifically forests, will lead to more production and the degradation of other ecosystems, of other biomes, such as grasslands, which also have a very high ecosystem value?
Yeah, that is certainly a risk. And for instance, if you look at soy in Brazil, around 10% of soy is grown in the Amazon biome, but 50% of the soy is used in the Cerrado area, and only part of the Cerrado where expansion is forest, and a large part is savanna. So there is indeed a risk, and it has already taken place in the past through the soy moratorium, where expansion in the Amazon was reduced. There is a risk that there will be shifts, and that is why there will be an evaluation after 1 or 2 years to see if other biomes or other wooded area, other areas should also be, the other areas than forests should also be included. And yeah, this is the start also here.
Thank you so much. It's been so interesting discussing this with you, and also it's been very interesting kind of hearing how you've been involved in it. And I think our final question that might interest our audience, especially the younger ones, is what advice would you have for someone that's seeking to pursue a career in policy, advocacy, or something linked to what you're doing?
Well, that's an interesting question. Now, I think first of all is be curious and ask questions to yourself and others on how and why things are the way they are. I think that's one. And yeah, of course you will need a certain education, etc. But I think first of all, curiosity and wondering why things are the way they are, and thinking of whom can do what to change that. I think curiosity is the main important thing there.
Thank you so much. I think we can move on to the yes or no questions now.
Okay.
That's all good with everyone. I'll let Rosarin take over from here.
So first question is, do you think that the EU deforestation regulation will reduce global deforestation?
And it's just two options, is it? I think yes.
Okay. Moving on to the second question.
So I will take away my butt then. Yeah. Yes. Yeah.
Is the EUDR what you hoped it would be?
Yes, when it's about the objectives. No, when it's about the details.
Is it possible to expect supply chains to become equitable in the close future?
Oh, that's an interesting question. I would say yes, it is possible. Yeah.
Final question. To what extent do these
regulations... That's why I'm here. That's why I'm doing this work. So, yeah, I keep thinking it is possible. Yeah.
Final question is, to what extent do these regulations, such as the EUDR or the German Supply Chain Act, force businesses to center human rights and environmental issues within their supply chain?
I do think they really contribute. Absolutely. And what I see, I can better judge for EUDR than for the German legislation, because I'm just following that more from a distance. I see a lot of dynamics and in some sectors even more than I had expected from companies that are really looking into their supply chain, wondering where is my product coming from and what is it that I need to do, first of all, to comply, but often then also the other issues come up. And so, yes, I am quite convinced and sometimes surprised in a positive way, that it is really stimulating companies to think of what it is that they are doing and how they can improve.
That's brilliant. Thank you so much, Gerd. It's so nice to be up, finished on a positive note.
Thank you
for speaking with us today. We've really enjoyed the conversation and found it really interesting. And you've brought out a lot of different angles, both human rights and environmental aspects of the EU deforestation regulation, which has been really interesting.
So we're coming to the end of today's episode. Thank you so much again, Geert van der Bijl, for joining us. And thank you so much to our listeners for tuning in for today's episode. Feel free to review and comment. You can find us by searching PureUK. See you next time.